You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you watched last night's Democratic debate, you could be forgiven for having not known that the rest of the world does not exist. There was virtually no conversation about the candidates' foreign policy, with a few scattered exceptions. And yet, that's a real problem, because not only is foreign policy the area on which the president has the most authority, but it's one in which there are absolutely massive divides between these candidates in a way that really hadn't been fleshed out until recently at this point in the race. So today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network, we are going to talk about these differences to understand where the Democratic Party is at on foreign policy, what the different perspectives are, and, you know, what it might look like if you have, say, a Michael Bloomberg versus a Bernie Sanders in office. I'm Zach Beauchamp, here as always with Jen Williams and Alex Ward.
Howdy.
Ready to debate.
You are.
No.
No. You're usually not that feisty at 9 o'clock in the morning.
I'm never feisty anyway.
That's true, actually.
False.
No. I think that's true. I think that's fair. When has Alex been feisty? He's the nice one on the show.
Okay.
On Slack?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But we can move on. Slack.
I think I come off worse on Slack than I really mean it.
Look, let's talk about Democratic foreign policy. So last night, by my count, there was a conversation about China and climate change, which is an important topic. I don't want to underplay it, but it's not the sum total of foreign policy. And the rest of the world sort of ignored, right?
Yeah, there was a bit of an exchange between Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg about the name of the Mexican president.
Right. It wasn't about Mexico policy
right.
in any depth. It was about Amy Klobuchar forgetting AMLO's name.
Yeah. So Andrés Manuel López Obrador, I think I said it okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Definitely said it better than Klobuchar did when she remembered it and called him Andre, but close enough. So that was basically they had the CNN town hall and she forgot his name. So there was a bit of an exchange there and he was criticizing her and was saying, you know, you sit on these committees in the Senate that oversee like trade deals with, you know, Mexico, one of our biggest trading partners, and you should probably know the name of the president of Mexico. And so there was a bit of an exchange and she came back. This is literally the only other foreign policy piece. She came back and responded, well, I do know how many people are in the Israeli Knesset, so the Israeli parliament. And she listed off
It's 120.
And he was like, well, I didn't know that. So that was pretty much the entire foreign policy section.
I guess it was climate change, right?
No,
right, as you mentioned.
China, I mean, climate change.
And to be fair, that's arguably the thing that they should be talking about the most. It is something that all Democrats have said would be one of their top priorities, if not the top foreign policy priority for them would be to combat climate change. So I'm totally fine for them discussing it. That said, there's not that much disagreement among them. Like I said, they're going to make it a top priority. They might have different policy proposals, but they're still going to tackle it pretty intensely. What I think is interesting is that sort of nuance about where China comes in,
yeah.
Right? Because I think you're seeing sort of across the board Democrats mostly making the case that you do have to work with China to solve climate change, which is just undeniably true.
Right. That's a fact.
Yeah, exactly. But how you do that in this time where they are, you know, putting Uyghurs in concentration camps, where they are cracking down on democracy, especially in Hong Kong, and continuing to threaten an American ally in Taiwan, like how do you sort of balance working on the world's greatest challenge while also maintaining an incredibly tense and complicated relationship? I want more nuance on that. I want more discussions on that. I think Bloomberg at least gave us an answer to it, one that similarly Tom Steyer gave to me in an interview I did with him. So it seems to be a billionaire love for China, which makes
a lot
of sense.
Can't imagine why.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. But at the end of the day, these are the kinds of discussions I wish would happen more just in the general election.
Let's talk about Bloomberg, actually, because I think not everyone appreciates just what an important role he plays in this in the context of foreign policy. Because Bloomberg has surged now to second in some national polls past Joe Biden, who is rapidly falling, and with Bernie Sanders in first place. This is because he has thrown a ton of money at various different states, and especially trying to sell himself as like best friends with Barack Obama. According to some journalists, they keep finding people who are like, wow, Barack Obama endorsed Mike Bloomberg? Impressive. The irony of this is that Bloomberg's foreign policy position is about as far from Obama as you can imagine, right? He recently said, like last month, said he did not regret his support for the Iraq war. He opposed the Iran nuclear deal and has refused to say that he supports it. He has taken a very, very hardline pro-Israel stance at times. And I know these are Middle East issues in general, but they're – because they were such the big ticket issues during the Obama presidency, I think they're really important to highlight where he's coming from, which is a shockingly right-wing perspective for a modern Democrat.
Just to be clear, I just want to clarify something really quickly. You didn't say – Obama didn't endorse him for president in this election.
Yes, Obama did not do that.
Right, okay.
Because of Bloomberg's ads.
Got it. I just want to clarify that.
The ads are – yes, sorry. The ads are tricking people. I want to be clear on this point. Mike Bloomberg wants you to think Obama endorsed him. This is not true.
Yeah. Getting back to his foreign policy, I think, one of the things that I was most looking forward to of having him in the debate was to actually get to hear him articulate some of his views on foreign policy because, this was his first time being in one of these debates. And he, he was a mayor of New York City, right? He didn't serve in the military. He doesn't, you wouldn't think that he has like national security cred or, defense credentials. But he does have foreign policy credentials in the sense that he runs a huge, philanthropic organization, and he runs a business that has, does business around the world. He does do a lot on climate change. His foundation, he brings together and runs conferences on climate change and summits and things like that. And, he has worked with people like, he's worked with, governments in China and world governments all around the world. And so you would think, I wanted to hear what he had to say, and they didn't ask any of it. But we do know a little bit about what he thinks from recent – so Council on Foreign Relations did this question and answer thing where they asked all the candidates a series of foreign policy questions, and he answered those. And he's did a similar thing with the New York Times. So he posed the Iran deal, like you said, and – one of his big criticisms, which was a common criticism at the time among those who didn't like the deal, was that it didn't go far enough, right? It didn't cover ballistic missiles, Iran's ballistic missile program, which is true. It didn't. The Obama administration made a concerted decision not to include that because they didn't think they could get a deal on that, and they wanted to just deal with the nuclear program itself. And he's also, criticized the Obama administration, saying that they smeared their critics and tried to, paint critics of the deal in a bad light. Also fairly valid. So I think, but most importantly, is his position on the Iraq war.
Yeah, simply enough, Bloomberg supported the Iraq war, still doesn't really seem to want to retract that at all. Asked about it consistently, he's just like, yeah, it was, don't really apologize for it, but believed it at the time, whatever. Which is surprising because, one, I just expect, when we were planning this episode, we were thinking, okay, this debate, someone's going to come in on Bloomberg for the Iraq thing. And, Elizabeth Warren et al. Went at him for everything but basically foreign policy.
Not everything. They didn't even mention his basically creation of a police state for Muslims in New York and even New Jersey, weirdly.
That's true. Right? There's that.
There are lots of things about Bloomberg that weren't covered. But foreign policy, as you said, is a glaring one.
Right. Or his subjugation of democracy in the sense of he gave himself a third term and no one else could have a third term.
That's right. That didn't come up.
But anyway, it is a surprising thing that they didn't bring this up. This is such a point that, like, Bernie brings up constantly on Joe Biden, right? Biden keeps getting hit hard for making a lot of mistakes in Iraq, which there's a long feature of it at Vox that we can put up. But all you really need to know is that he basically any kind of decision that he made ended up making things worse.
So when we talk about Mike Bloomberg supported the Iraq war, I want to be clear, like, what we actually mean. Because when we talk about Biden supporting the Iraq war, like, he literally voted for it because he was in Congress at the time.
Right.
And then, you know, in the Obama administration continued and, you know, sent troops and all that stuff, and they pulled troops out, but they continued the war. So Bloomberg, you know, wasn't in a position to, like, vote. He wasn't in Congress. He was mayor of New York City really shortly after 9/11. And, like, he stood up with the First Lady Laura Bush at one event. It was in, I think, 2004. And he's literally, like, saying, he's standing, I think, you know, near Ground Zero, and he's talking about how the Iraq war started here, like, started on 9/11. So he was – this was at the time when that, like, contention that, you know, 9/11 was connected to the Iraq war in any way, shape, or form, which, by the way, it wasn't, for everyone who doesn't remember. That was pretty much being challenged very heavily at that time, and he was like, no, like, this is – you know, he was standing beside, you know, the president's wife. So – that when we talk about supporting it, I just want to make it clear, like, he didn't vote in any way. And so when he talks about it, he does say, you know, he called it, you know, America's worst foreign policy mistake ever, the invasion of Iraq, which I think that's a fair thing to say. I think I appreciate that, you know, correct. It is one of the bad ones. But he doesn't apologize. And one of the reasons why is, like, he says his defense is like, well, I didn't, like, do anything. Like, I didn't, like, vote for it. It wasn't my idea. So he tries to get out of it that way by saying, like, well, I wasn't in the Senate like these guys were. So I'm just saying, like, that's
– it's like a non-apology, right?
Wait, no, I'm not defending him. I'm just explaining, because people keep saying, like, he supported the Iraq war, but that's kind of, like, in what way? So I wanted to make it clear for people what that means, because it's not like he, you know, did any votes or anything like that.
He was a vocal supporter.
But he literally stood up and supported at a time when the entire premise of the war was deeply – deeply being debated, and he perpetuated the Bush administration's lie, essentially.
Like, Bloomberg has taken this sort of consistently, I think it's fair to call it, neoconservative line in the way that he's done things. It's more than liberal interventionism, right? It's not that. It's further in the hawkish direction, I would say, given the stance on the Iran deal and the Iraq war combined, that you did used to see in the Democratic Party around 2004. Of course, at that point, Bloomberg was so far right that he was literally standing up endorsing George W. Bush and praising his handling of the war on terror and foreign policy.
Was he a Republican at the time?
He was, in fact, a Republican at the time. Yeah.
And he's also mayor of New York City, which,
okay.
A lot of people at the time did support the war for those reasons, because the administration was lying.
But in 2004, it's pretty clear that there was no, as you were just saying, 9/11
It was at a point where people were literally, like, arguing, like, no, that's not true. There's no connection. How did you possibly make that connection? And he was like, no, this is, you know, I support this war because of the terrorists did the bad thing.
I just find it remarkable because in many ways, Barack Obama's 2008 primary victory was a repudiation of this idea in toto. The core argument that he made against Hillary Clinton back then was the Iraq war was a mistake. She voted for it. That's bad judgment. You should vote for me instead. There were other things that he said, but at that point, the war was still a complete disaster. It was still going on, and everyone was furious about it. And that propelled him to primary victory. I think it's fair to say more than any other single factor, that is why Obama won. More than any other single factor. I don't want to be monocausal. I just want to say it's the most important of several that mattered. So his foreign policy was more radical in some ways than anything else that he did as president in terms of shifting the center of gravity in the Democratic Party in a left direction. And Bloomberg would be a giant step back towards where Democrats were in the past. Whereas the other person who's at the top of the polls, in fact, the current frontrunner by almost every conceivable metric, Bernie Sanders, he's the opposite, right? Sanders's foreign policy isn't just let's keep doing what Obama was doing. It's to develop a new and more aggressively progressive vision of what it means to run foreign policy, which I think is very interesting, right? Because it's it's rhetorically different, certainly in some key ways, but I'm not sure how substantively different it is.
There's one thing I think that really puts a really fine point on it. I can't remember if it's New York Times or Council on Foreign Relations. I'm sorry. But one of the two asked basically point blank, in what situations would you use military force? And Bloomberg said he wouldn't use it for regime change, which that's interesting, right? And that's an important thing to say. But he came out and listed and said, yeah, for to support, to maintain the free flow of oil in the world, I would use military force, particularly in like the Strait of Hormuz, in the Gulf. Like he said that explicitly. And I think like war for oil, we've had episodes on this before, but like the entire concept of like fighting a war just for oil is something that I think the average like progressive Democrat would probably scream bloody murder at that concept. But the fact that, you know, Bloomberg is a businessman, right? He is a billionaire. He sees this like oil as this important commodity that we need to have versus someone like a Bernie Sanders, who I can't imagine would be like, yeah, we should totally start a full-fledged war in the Middle East to make sure oil keeps flowing. And I think that in and of itself, more than, because the regime change issue actually pushes Bloomberg more to the left.
I mean, I guess, like, I read that too, and I kind of took it as a very, yes, I think your interpretation is fair. But I do think it was poorly worded, because the way I took it was, like, he would be aggressive in allowing sort of the free flow of trade and, you know, like, defending sea lanes and all this kind of stuff. And, like, Democrats have head faked to that, too. They've consistently said, like, we would use American military power to protect the free flow of trade and you know, shipping lanes and whatever it may be. Now, what they would do in practice in office may be a separate thing, and maybe Bloomberg was more forceful, but that does seem to be a, still a common Democratic position that, like, they are definitely more skeptical of force than, I say, the general Republican or even, or you know, the current president. But I don't think they have really shied away that much from force to protect like core U.S. national interests. In fact, you know, Bernie's team continually pushes back against this notion that he's an isolationist.
Right.
You know, constantly saying like, you know, he would go after bad guys, go after terrorists, et cetera, it may be, you know, protect the American economy as necessary. So I guess I see it more in that vein. But yeah, I mean, I've read it that way too. But I also agree with your interpretation in that like it was a strongly worded statement.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty blunt in a way that I was like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
No, it was oddly specific.
Yeah.
One thing I think that's interesting about the Sanders approach, in contradistinction to the sort of traditional Democratic or like to say nothing about the Bloomberg style approach, is that there's almost a return to Bush style democracy promotion, but without the Bush style part of it. And by that, I mean he is really concerned about the spread of authoritarianism internationally. And a lot of his foreign policy statements, speeches, utterances coming from his foreign policy advisor, who Matt Duss, who I should say is a longtime friend of mine, so I can't say anything bad about Matt. Love him. But even if we disagree on certain issues. But the thing that's striking about Sanders' approach here is that he thinks that global corruption is directly tied in, closely linked to the spread of authoritarianism, which I think is true, right? It's that you have these webs of international finance and money flowing around in dark ways, and that can be used to funnel money to international far-right groups that work to subvert democracy in different places. And so his core proposition, the thing that distinguishes him from, well, everyone except for Elizabeth Warren, who has endorsed a very similar foreign policy in the field, is this focus on the negative impacts of global political economy on both, you know, the well-being of the global economy and on inequality, but also on democracy itself, right? And on the rise of far right
as yeah. well. And I think, again, like not to harp on the oil point, but like if you see, you know, compare, you know, Bloomberg also said, yes, you know, we should press Saudi on getting better on their human rights, but like we need Saudi Arabia. They're a very close ally. They're very important. Contrast that again with Bernie Sanders, who literally has called them like murderous thugs, like the Saudi regime, which is the strongest I've ever heard any political, you know, candidate for president ever be about the Saudis. Whereas Bloomberg takes the very kind of center right position that we need Saudi Arabia in particular to counter Iran, to counter Iranian hegemony in the region, and to support Israel. Like, it is the longstanding kind of U.S. foreign policy blob practice of, like, we need Saudi, they're the best, even though they're super not. And Sanders is, like, the radical one. He's, like, they're literally, like, murderous thugs who are assassinating people and that's disgusting. And
again, where's the lie?
Right, exactly. And that is like, but that's a huge break. Like hearing somebody say that is a really, I don't think people understand how radical it is to hear a candidate for president who is, you know, polling at the top, not just some fringe candidate, speaking so harshly about a longstanding U.S., you know, partner in the Middle East, and good for him.
Yeah, I think the Saudis lost the Democratic Party as a whole. That's, I think, just a natural byproduct of killing Khashoggi and Trump's hugging of the royal family,
right,
et cetera.
But not Bloomberg, which is interesting.
But not Bloomberg, again, to put a fine point on it, Bloomberg is more continuity with Trump than anyone else. Not to say that they would be similar in many ways, but, like, in terms of foreign policy thinking, I think they are more similar than, like, Bloomberg and Trump are closer than anyone else.
In fact, there's an important point to be made there, which is that Bloomberg has expressed admiration in many ways for East Asian authoritarian states, most notably China and Singapore, because they fit his idea, his sort of domestic model of a more aggressive, intrusive state designed to promote public health through power and public order and safety. But that fits with a vision that's very much at odds with the Sanders view, right, where these governments are, while we may need to work with them, they are part of a global web of financial and economic corruption that is damaging democracy internationally. Whereas Bloomberg is like, whatever, that's how I made all my money.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I want to be very clear. There is a movement, and we've talked about on the show before, that is under an umbrella term called progressive foreign policy. And it has very much highlighted this anti-corruption message as one of the central pillars. In fact, it's usually like diplomacy over military might, climate change is a top priority, and go after corrupt practices in order to improve democracy. That's kind of the main three. We can quibble, but those are, in my mind, kind of the main three pillars of it. I talked to a lot of people in the campaigns and also just politicians currently in Congress about what, you know, what they think about this. And I gotta say, I think they're a little bit naive about this anti-corruption push. I get the notion. I get its importance. I get that it might even be an on the whole good. But if I'm, you know, if I'm in Moscow, if I'm in Beijing, if I'm in Riyadh, and I see that you have leaders like Bernie Sanders et al. Pushing for like a grassroots anti-corruption movement that would lead to kind of the dissolution of the system that I've built where I am, I kind of see that as a bigger threat than like a military buildup, because that is the end to my way of life, to my system of governance, to my way of rule. And if you want the United States to kind of foment this pro-democratic feeling, which sounds good in theory, and in fact in practice, I could imagine this actually leading to a lot more consternation and friction between the United States and authoritarian governments, which you may like, but there are reasons to need some sort of good relationships with Russia and with China and with Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I am worried that this is sort of seen as a panacea and a very good policy that will be pushed on very intensely by a Democratic president, especially a Sanders or a Warren or someone like that. But I think they might actually find more problems, at least in the short term, than they will find than success.
I mean, there's also the argument that has been part of that for a long time is that, you know, we would like for example, Saudi Arabia, we would love for them not to be like a super repressive, brutal, dictatorial regime. We also don't want a failed state in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And that has been the argument, like, you want to see, you know, a bad situation in the Middle East, watch the Saudi regime fall and see what happens. Or, you know, Egypt or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's also that argument.
Agreed.
So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to move a little bit away from Bloomberg versus Sanders and talk about the rest of the field, where they fit on the spectrum that we've established in this part.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the future of entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, worldly listeners. We are talking about the Democratic primary's foreign policy debate. I mean, okay, the lack thereof during the actual physical debate on Wednesday night, but also more broadly, the way the candidates are arguing with each other and developing different proposals throughout the campaign. Now, we've set up sort of a spectrum here with Bloomberg as a return to pre-Obama Democratic foreign policy and Sanders as a move towards a new, more left-wing vision of what it could be. Now, there's also the whole rest of the field.
Wait,
right?
What?
He falls somewhere in between those two.
Also, I totally just forgot that Tulsi Gabbard's totally still in the race.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
but
what?
Yeah, Tulsi Gabbard is in the race somehow, implausibly, and doesn't really fit well on the spectrum that we've described because there's no space for mass murderer sympathizer here. Sorry, Tulsi stans. I do not take your candidate seriously.
She's kind of a—
You might want to explain that.
A party of one.
Oh, she's— I've written about her a lot. She's been astonishingly close with the Assad regime in Syria, secretly visiting them at one point, has defended Russia's intervention there as an attack on terrorists when, in fact, they've been murdering civilians. She argued that Russia was doing Obama's job for him by, again, murdering civilians in the legitimate Syrian opposition.
She's also pretty supportive of the far-right Hindu government in India.
Right, which is currently putting the entire province of Kashmir on lockdown.
Right.
And
so— Not
creating
great.
Plans to strip Muslims of citizenship, right? It's— she is, I think, she has largely indefensible foreign policy views that bill themselves as anti-war but are in actuality pro-mass murder and pro-human rights abuses. Again, sorry, Tulsi, but these are the stances that you yourself have publicly taken.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about them,
come
like,
on the show.
Yeah, agree to my interview request.
She's literally, like, separate from the spectrum.
Yeah.
So with Gabbard, who's a non-factor in the polls aside, right, I think everybody probably fits somewhere between Bloomberg and Sanders on a roughly linear spectrum, as much as you can make foreign policy linear. Now, among the leaders in the race, judged by top national polling, Biden, I think, is almost squarely, exactly in between those two polls, basically running on a restoration of the Obama administration, which, of course, he was part of, as he will tell you.
Like, literally anytime. A restoration of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, do exactly what I did when I was in office then, even though he wasn't making the foreign policy decisions.
Tom Steyer, too, isn't his entire—
Yeah, when I talked to Steyer, he was pretty much, like, basically any question I asked him, and it was a short interview, and he was hurried. He was in a car and, like, trying to get to the airport, but still, anything I asked him, he was just like, yeah, well, we got to go back to the Obama days, or, like, do what Obama did. And just like, all right, fine. Granted, he hasn't really thought about foreign policy much. I think he was most fluent on China, as I sort of alluded to at the beginning, but in the way of just, like, we can't get rid of China. We've got to be friends with him somehow and whatever.
Yeah.
And just very briefly on Biden, I think it's important that he has started to distance himself a bit from Obama, though, on foreign policy. For example, he basically called out Obama for adding more troops to Afghanistan, saying that he opposed it, right? On Iraq, he was kind of calling out Obama, being like, some of the decisions I disagreed with, even though I was kind of the mastermind and I got our troops out, ignoring a lot of the facts on the ground. He has— And in other instances, he's kind of pulled back from, like, yeah, Obama went further than I would have. So it's interesting that on kind of like on foreign policy, that's where Biden has started to separate a little bit from Obama more than anything else, saying that he wouldn't be as militarily adventurous as Obama was.
I'm really interested in the other sort of top national poll leader, Elizabeth Warren, who had a great debate last night, really took the hammer to Bloomberg on his nasty history with women and female employees. But on foreign policy, I think it's very fascinating, right? Because she sounds exactly like Bernie Sanders when she talks. There's no real distinction in the way that they write about their foreign policies, their speeches. You could copy paste one from the other and it would be virtually identical. Their votes in Congress
are different. Story.
Yeah. Warren's actual record is much closer to the sort of median point inside the Democratic Party than Sanders is, who's been consistently a sort of left-wing gadfly on this issue until now the party has sort of moved in his direction.
Yeah, I mean, she, for example, importantly on trade, she was supportive of this recent USMCA, saying that, you know, in her mind, it's important to get some gains for workers now, and she'll continue to fight for them and make some improvements along, whereas Bernie was like, no, this is bad across the board. I'm going to vote no. I think that's where they've started to separate probably more than anywhere else. And I think this is an important distinction. They are both pretty much skeptical of free trade in general. But I think Warren did see a bit of writing on the wall in that there were unions that came out in support of USMCA. And the second she got that, she was kind of like, all right, fine. I think I'll vote for this. I think Sanders a bit for ideological purity and also just to kind of maybe get some separation from Warren decided I'm going to vote against. But I think it's important in the macro sense that this sort of left wing led by Sanders and Warren does seem to be more skeptical of the usual free trade consensus that Democrats and Republicans have believed in for years.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, on trade in particular, I think is, again, and not to keep harping back to Bloomberg, but is again where you see, I think, a very radical difference between Bloomberg himself and the whole rest of the Democratic slate right now for 2020. He is very much pro, you know, free trade and globalization and, you know, for probably obvious reasons, right? I mean, if you look at them ideologically and in their background, like, Bloomberg is literally like a billionaire businessman who owns a whole bunch of stuff and companies and does business around the world. He has a big, you know, philanthropic organization that does stuff all around the world, and is just kind of built on that idea. And, you know, Bernie is literally the opposite, and Warren are literally the opposite of that. They're very pro-union. I mean, you're not going to have a Mike Bloomberg be super pro-union, I imagine, because, you know, he's literally a businessman. That's kind of the opposite thing. But, you know, we've seen, like you said, like the Democratic Party, you know, used to be, you know, the Bill Clinton administration, right, used to be this, like, you know, pro-free trade, like pro, you know, globalization. That was like the whole big thing.
Obama too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think Bernie Sanders has led that kind of, you know, push. And Warren is also part of that in, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, her CFPB, and her kind of anti-corruption thing in general, very much, you know, pulled the Democratic Party, I think, in many ways, Bernie kind of leading it with, you know, Warren as part of that, you know, much farther to the left on trade. And with the recognition that, like Trump has said, you know, and recognized that the current, you know, global trade regime was not working for American workers. And so they're very focused on bringing that back, whereas Bloomberg is very much not. And it seems like pretty much most of the Democratic Party is kind of on that side, closer to the Bernie Warren end.
I find this very interesting because if you look at polling on free trade, it's the exact opposite, right? Trade was losing to a degree popularity, not a ton, but losing some in the run-up to the Trump administration. But it's gotten a lot more popular because Trump's trade wars have been, by all accounts, a complete catastrophe. And Democrats in particular, because a lot of foreign policy positions especially and trade policy especially, if you look historically at the polling, is determined by partisanship because people don't actually understand the details of these different things. They see them as connected to their partisan identity. So when Trump becomes aggressively anti-trade, Democrats in reaction become more and more pro-trade because they don't want to be like Trump. So in this sense, though there's like a center of gravity that's more hostile towards new trade agreements and even towards trying to pull back from some of the old ones that we've struck among the Democratic primary candidates, the actual Democratic electorate is weirdly enough much closer to Mike Bloomberg than any of the other people on this one. I also happen to think substantively free trade is good and the old Democratic consensus was closer to correct on this particular issue than the new one. But that's not really what we're talking about. That could be a whole episode on its own. Sorry, worldly listeners. No, we'll get there eventually.
I mean, it's also a smart electoral strategy, I think, for Sanders, who believes he has a shot at beating Trump, obviously. And, you know, the real battleground, it looks like early on in this election, will be in the Midwest. And that, a lot of people claim that part of the reason Trump won was because he did appeal to economic anxiety. I know there's some—
No, that's not true. I want to be very clear on this point.
Hold on. Before we go into that, I think it's undeniable that he did speak to a section of the electorate that was worried about globalization run amok and hurting the manufacturing parts of the United States. I think that's undeniably true. You might not think that's the number one reason, and that's
fine. No. I think it's deniable. I think that is not— this is not what the episode is about, but the data is very clear that there's very, very little linkage between actual trade or between sense of anxiety about trade or damage from trade and odds of Trump support. It's just very, very limited, and it's always swamped when you look at the statistical controls by proxies that look at cultural variables like education.
And that's so fine.
It's
but
just not the case.
Okay, but either way—
it's a myth.
I'm not— either
that's
way—
that's right. I'm with you on this one, Alex, but that's okay.
Either way, like, I think Sanders is trying to appeal to the same kind of voters that he may believe that Trump— like, that he wants to take away from Trump in the Midwest and areas like that. And I think going against the free trade consensus is a way to do that. At least I think that's part of the strategy here. Also, Sanders has felt this way.
I mean, there were also, just anecdotally, there were like a whole bunch of people who supported Bernie and then decided to vote for Trump for a lot of the economic reasons because of the message about, you know, making country work better for working people and regular Americans. So
anecdated, I think this is the problem with this entire approach, is it assumes an electorate that is anxious about certain things when it's actually anxious about other things. And like,
but this is a separate debate. Yeah.
Yes.
But, okay. So,
but I do want to add one thing, which and Sanders and Warren, I think they are incorrectly maligned for like not caring about the armed services or national security or you know military affairs. Sanders was chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee for a long time. He's been in Congress for a long time and has taken tough votes and has thought about these issues. He's been leading pretty clearly lately on like war powers resolutions against Yemen, working on like to stopping Trump's Iran policy. Warren obviously has a more limited experience here, but she did go on Senate Armed Services Committee where she still serves. And she's been pretty tough against military officials, especially on Afghanistan. And she's learned a lot on the job, hired staff that has brought her up to speed. And so she does have a coherent foreign policy view. You can disagree with it, which is totally fine. But and more importantly, I think for that, she's also developed a national security military view, which is interesting. And of course, she consistently notes that she had three brothers in the military. So yes, you can still be left-wing and very skeptical of war and military intervention and all that, but I still think that they do have interesting views and do have a familiarity with these issues.
So before we sign off, I do want to talk a little bit about two candidates we have not discussed very much, Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, who have both done reasonably well in some of the early primaries, Buttigieg especially. And there's, I think, a reason we haven't been talking about them, especially Buttigieg, which is that, as Alex points out in a very good recent piece on Vox.com, he has stopped answering foreign policy questions. He's just not talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I should, before I go into that, he is, if you have a survey or a questionnaire you want to give, right, if Vox.com created a foreign policy survey right now and we sent it to all the campaigns, who knows who would respond? But Buttigieg probably wouldn't. And the reason is, the campaign has a policy now that if he has answered a question before, he's just going to refer that organization to his previous statements. And people noticed this with a recent New York Times survey on foreign policy stances, where a lot of them, they were just like, he didn't answer, or they referred back to a previous speech he'd given or a previous answer he'd given. And I think they're doing that mostly in my conversations with the campaign, because a lot of people are taking these things out of context and like, why would he sort of reiterate something he'd already said? That's, I guess, somewhat defensible.
He's also
but
literally not answering a new question that he has never answered before that you have asked him.
Well, that's where
repeatedly.
I was going to next, which is like Trump did reverse the landmine policy or change the landmine policy. The TLDR here is now the U.S. military can use landmines pretty much anywhere if a commander feels it's appropriate. And I've asked all the Democratic campaigns, the major ones, if they would reverse it. Many of them got back to me. Buttigieg did not. I also asked about whether they would take low-yield nuclear weapons. Remember the Armini nuke episode off of submarines? Only two got back to me. Buttigieg did not. And so it does seem like if you are emailing the campaign about foreign policy, you're just not going to get an answer.
But in general, you know, if we are going to talk about where he is on the spectrum, I think he is very much in the center. That's his whole kind of shtick, right? I don't know if shtick's the right word.
Yeah, but now it is. Yeah, I think. It wasn't early
on. That's his
on.
Whole, you know, platform is he is the moderate centrist in the Democratic Party. He is not the, you know, radical democratic socialist, and he is not Mike Bloomberg. You know, and he is the only one – well, Tulsi Gabbard also served, but we've already decided she's off the conversation. But, you know, he served in the military. Pete Buttigieg did. So he has, you know, a somewhat more centrist – position. He does also support, you know, ending foreign wars. They pretty much all say that. So that's kind of where he is, just for people who are listening and may not know where he falls.
I do think his most important stance, though, is he did promise to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan in his first year. Not first term, as a lot of candidates have said, his first year.
That's fast.
That is fast. The other one who said that was Gabbard, by the way, the two veterans.
So Klobuchar.
Klobuchar has only really given one foreign policy speech, as far as I know, at the Council on Foreign Relations. It was pretty standard, and
you
like,
can say vacuous. It's okay.
No, like they all are vacuous, right? At this point, I mean,
yeah.
There's a reason why no one's really being specific on foreign policy, because I think in the same way with a presidency, a bad foreign policy stance can break your campaign, and it doesn't really make it, right? Like Klobuchar, had she gotten the Mexican president's name right, would have been fine. That's what she's supposed to do. Getting it wrong, it caused a bad news cycle and a bad moment in debate for her. So look, in the speech, she was pretty, I think, down the middle, regular Democrat on foreign policy. Free trade, good. Do have to worry about, how this affects agricultural workers and manufacturers. But overall, it's fine. We've got to, you know, promote democracy again. We've got to stand up to the bad guys. Bread and butter stuff. Nothing that was really radical. And she's not really been known as a foreign policy person. This is something she's learning as she goes. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that she needs to start talking about more, especially if she wants to be, I think, a leader in the party.
Right. And I think, you know, I agree that, you know, and Warren made this point pretty sharply in the debate last night that, you know, the fact that she blanked on someone's name in and of itself doesn't necessarily mean she doesn't know anything about foreign policy and doesn't, you know, that was the point Warren made was like, look, you can blank out and have a you know, dumb moment where you, you know, forget like your third point in a debate, for example, you know. But Elizabeth Warren's point was like, okay, but, you know, judge her on her actual policies and like, you know, what does she actually believe? What does she know on the policies? The problem, which gets to what you just said, Alex, is that she also hasn't been very clear there in terms of detailed plans. But again, very few have, except Joe Biden. And when you go back and look, if you look at every one of those surveys, in particular the New York Times profile, if you look at the answers that these candidates have given on foreign policy, it is a staggering night versus day difference between Biden's answers and literally everyone else's.
That's
in terms
right.
of detail, in terms of knowledge, it is breathtaking. Now, I'm not saying I agree with all of his stances, but in terms of the knowledge, he knows the leaders' names. He knows very detailed, minute level, like, conflict dynamics in a way that nobody else comes even close. And I think that, you know, is helpful for him if this were a foreign policy election. It clearly isn't, which I think is why nobody else is really bothering to put much thought into detailed foreign policy. Even Elizabeth Warren, who is known for having a plan on everything, it's very detailed down to, you know, very minute level. On foreign policy, not so much.
I want you guys, listeners, to mark this down. This is the day that you found out that Jen is a Biden stan.
Vox Media and Vox.com and individual Vox journalists do not endorse candidates.
That's true.
As a policy.
Can I push back on Warren's argument on the Klobuchar-AMLO thing?
Oh, sure.
So I'm not saying it is disqualifying that Klobuchar didn't know the name. People can always forget things. That's fine. But let's say
– she should have known it.
You should know it. You're in the United States. Like, but let's also think about this. It seems like it's weirdly more acceptable. I wonder if Warren would have said that had she had Klobuchar forgotten, let's say, Trudeau's name, right? There's something it seems that, like, the U.S. should know everything about Canada and not really much about Mexico. It is an a very important partner. It is our southern neighbor. We rely on them tremendously. If you care about avocados, you need to care about U.S. policy towards Mexico.
Now you have that jingle stuck in my head.
Yeah, sorry.
Avocados from Mexico.
But Buttigieg kind of made that point, too, about Klobuchar.
Yeah.
He said, like,
right.
Look, you actually, like, sit on committees and oversee trade deals.
Exactly.
And you don't know, as he put it, literally the first thing about Mexico.
And yeah. Homeland Security. Politics.
And,
yeah.
Like, fair enough.
I agree. And I think that there is this sort of, and this has been true of the Democratic Party, that it has ignored Latin America, Central America, South America, the Caribbean even, almost consistently throughout the campaign. There was another one of these questionnaires, and only two candidates responded to it. That, I should say, though, Joe Biden has written a lot of, like, op-eds about U.S. policy towards Latin America. But
Julian Castro also had a lot to say.
Well, this is what I was going to say, is that, like, you know, and then the guy who talked about it the most is out of the race. And so and when I talked to Julian Castro about his foreign policy, he was like, one of my first trips will be, I'm actually going to go to that Northern Triangle region, which a president had not done in a long time, or maybe ever, honestly. I can't remember. But all this to say is that there does seem to be, yes, of course, they're not talking about foreign policy as we would like, but I do think a specific miss on Latin America, which is incredibly important to us. Of course, I would love to hear more about Africa policy as well. But for a region that you know, that touches our borders, it is a surprising lack of depth and understanding and policy on that.
Which
on that
is
region.
Why I completely agree, Alex. Which is why we are officially calling on all of the Democratic candidates and the DNC to come to the worldly foreign policy only debate. Just kidding, we're not holding that. But that would be really cool if they had
that.
Like a foreign policy only debate. They did a climate change only debate where they had all the candidates on for, oh my God, so many hours just to talk about climate change, which was awesome because they could get into really detailed policies. I would love to see that on foreign policy. That will probably never, ever happen ever. And they are definitely not going to come on our show to do it.
But I don't know. Cool. Yeah. Candidates, if you're listening, then we are – consider this a standing invitation.
Open invitation.
To come on Worldly for any of you to talk about your foreign policy positions. We're very interested in having that discussion. We're also interested from hearing from our listeners if you have strong feelings about this Democratic primary, about the way the foreign policy debate is shaping up. Email us at worldly@vox.com. And I want to thank the people who make this whole show possible that you all enjoy listening to and potentially sending us angry emails about. Those people are our engineer, Malachi Brodus, and our producer, Jackson Bierfeldt. Make sure, after you listen to the show, to rate, subscribe, and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot, y'all.
Bye.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.